The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We have six cases on our calendar this morning. Four patent cases, one for the PTO, three for district courts. The protest from the Court of Federal Claims, the W employee case, and in that case, the one of the patent cases, two patent cases are submitted. In our first case is Memory Link Corporation versus Motorola, 2010-15-33, Mr. Shasta.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Shasta. I represent the Plaintiff Appellant Memory Corporation. This is a de novo review of the Northern District of Illinois Rule 12b-6 dismissal of the pleadings. This court has jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. because this patent attorney malpractice case necessarily involves federal law. I would like to begin by turning our attention to the attorney-client relationship, where the district court made incorrect rulings about when the attorney-client relationship began and when it ended. But to take a step back, the thing I don't understand in this case are arguments and conclusions that imply that in-house attorneys operate under different ethical rules than law firm attorneys. For example, to me, to argue that a patent law firm is not retained until the formal patent office power of attorney is executed, to argue that an attorney-client relationship with a patent law firm did not exist when the patent law firm had received confidential proprietary information for the purpose of running a prior art search and expressing a legal opinion as to patent eligibility, to me, to argue that a patent law firm that had done nothing to terminate the attorney-client relationship, they had not withdrawn as attorneys of record under 37 CFR 133, they had not revoked the power of attorney under 37 CFR 136A, they were still paying maintenance fees on an issued patent. They were still the principal attorneys of record on still pending patent applications. To argue that these patent attorneys had somehow inferentially terminated the attorney-client privilege.
But wasn't this malpractice complaint filed too late in terms of both patents? 352. There certainly was plenty of opportunity for Memory Link to have knowledge of the fact that the Motorola inventors were being added. And with respect to 938, the patent issued more than 6 years before the malpractice.
Well, in the absence of fraudulent concealment, it may well have been too late, but here we have a strong case of fraudulent concealment. Here we have attorneys who entered into an inherent conflict of interest, never apprised the client that they were entering into an inherent conflict of interest, and thus they breached their duty to disclose material facts. Here we have...
You're talking about the Motorola attorneys.
We're talking about the Motorola attorneys.
Well, quite obvious that they were representing the Motorola inventors, and as well as the Memory Link inventors who signed the power of attorney.
And so they were representing both clients. That's absolutely correct, and they had duties to both of those clients. But the initial duty was to inform Memory Link that they were entering into an inherent conflict of interest, and then Memory Link could choose to waive that conflict by written waiver. Memory Link was never even informed of that conflict of interest, and one cannot expect lay people to understand the attorney conflict of interest rules. In addition, those attorneys then favored the interest of one client over the interest of another client, both in the inventorship determination, which erroneously listed Motorola inventors, as well as a faulty assignment document. They never apprised Memory Link of that.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, thus, again, breaching their duty to disclose material facts.
You mentioned the assignment document. I'm a little unclear, just as a factual matter, how the assignments, this is back in June of 98, how does the assignments operate? Because we have, in the record, two documents, and there are references in the record to two different documents, one of which that I think appears at A279, which appears to assign the rights of the inventors to Motorola solely, and the other at A70 through 71, which appears to assign the rights of the inventors to Motorola and Renderlink jointly. What sort that out for you? Which one is operative? Which one? Was there a sequence of events or what? Because the briefs don't spell this
out. I'm sorry. We don't think either one of them is operative because we don't think that there was consideration for an assignment because the basis of the assignment is correct.
Give me just the facts as to what happened because these two look inconsistent to me.
The inventors assigned the patent jointly to Motorola in memory. Later, Motorola filed an assignment document with the patent office, and they neglected to list MemoryLink as a joint owner. They only listed Motorola as a joint owner. So on the face of the patent, Motorola is listed as the sole assignee.
Even though that's not supported by the inventor's assignment?
Even though it's not true. And we believe that's an operative fact in the underlying scheme here. And that was to have a patent issue in Motorola's name that Motorola's competitors would believe was Motorola's patent.
Well, I didn't understand. I understood your focus in the prior action and this action to be on the inclusion of the, inclusion of the Motorola inventors, or the Motorola employees as inventors, rather than deception or even flat-out
fraud,
whatever, as to the conversion from jointly Motorola and MemoryLink into Motorola alone.
There was no conversion. They simply filed an erroneous cover sheet with the assignment at the patent office. But the effect of that was the patent would then issue only with Motorola's name on the face of it, so it would appear to the world as Motorola's patent.
Well, when you say appear to the world, does that mean that it wasn't only Motorola's patent? It actually belonged to both Motorola and MemoryLink?
It was legally assigned jointly to Motorola and MemoryLink.
You say MemoryLink actually has a legal interest in this patent.
Well, they have a legal interest in the patent.
All right, that answers my question. So it never was really legally assigned to Motorola.
No, not just to Motorola. They have an interest in the patent, but it's an interest that was assigned under what I call a naked assignment, which merely said the parties jointly own this. As your honors are aware, under federal patent law, that results in a rather unique circumstance. It's not the same thing as real property. If you and I jointly own real property and you make money off of it, I get an accounting. I get to get some of those profits. Under joint patent ownership, either one of us could exploit that patent without giving any accounting, without answering to the other owner. And so even the patent office website has a provision.
Except that the other owner can also keep you from exploiting the patent by refusing to agree, for example, to the license.
No, they absolutely not. Either under 35 U.S.C. 262, either owner can exploit that patent without any accounting to the other owner. They can license it. They can get royalties for it.
The only thing you can't do is file an infringement suit.
That's true. Right. That's true. And again, so we couldn't even file an infringement suit with our ownership. That's exactly right.
And they can't grant exclusive rights.
Exactly. Now, what this did, though, was it allowed Motorola, to put this patent into their patent pool with their competitors where they have pick agreements. And what these pick agreements do is, if you and I are competitors, I get to pick a certain number of patents that you like.
This is interesting, but I don't see how it goes with the statute of repose issue, which is the only issue that we're really trying to figure out. So if you don't mind, I'd like to turn you back. In particular, 938 patent, because you're running out of time.
Yeah.
I don't mean to cut you off.
No, sure.
The 938 patents, one thing Motorola argues, and I'd like to hear your response, is that the issuance of the patent itself should constitute public brief notice and that even if their filing of the application was fraudulent at the time, they've at least started ticking with the patent issue. Mm-hmm. So how do you respond?
I back up one step, and I reject this idea that you could dissect this case into two different cases, one related to one patent and the other related to the secret patent. I think it's all the same case.
Well,
it's a single malpractice
case.
But to your point,
if you were on notice with regard to any of this, then statute of repose would start ticking in this case for fraud.
That's true. So having said that, I think the Federal Circuit case law is clear that while there is a some areas, like for licensing and ownership areas, where there is a provision where once the patent issues, you are constructively put on notice of the issuance of that patent, I think it's clear that for something substantive like this, the case law is clear that simply because a patent issued, you are not put on actual notice or constructive notice of the existence of that patent.
What case law is clear?
I'll get that for you in a second. In fact, I only have 15 seconds left, so I'll give that to you on rebuttal. I will have to get that to you on rebuttal. I don't have it with me right now.
There's a case that begins with A, it's called Latches, which is quite the same.
It's not the same, but it's the same logic and it's the same principle because both are equitable principles and the standard was the same, whereas knew or reasonably should have known, which is the same standard here. So the same, even though it's a little bit different, it's both equitable principles and they're both the same standard.
Regarding timing, you can't say the rest of it now or use a little bit of
Unless your honors have any more questions, I prefer to come back up. Thank you.
What is the story of these two assignments? How did this go from assignment which the name was to Motorola and memory to assignment to Motorola alone?
At Closition, my name is Nancy Dries and I represent the defendants at Hollies for the record. Your Honor, my understanding is that the assignment was executed by the parties in June, on June 11th and 12th, assigning the patent to both Motorola and memory, and had four employees, two of which were Motorola employees. I think when it got filed, my understanding is that when it was filed with the patent office, the recordation sheet only showed that Motorola was the assignee, but the full assignment was included with that. There was no dispute in this action that was the full assignment part. Again, good morning. May it please the court. The issue before the court is the application of the Illinois statute of repose and statute of limitations. Under Illinois public policy and finality, those two statutes, 2 years and 6 years, bar this case, and the lower court properly dismissed this action as time barred. The statute of repose is most dispositive in this case, and under that statute, a legal malpractice claim may not be commenced more than 6 years after the last date on which the alleged malpractice act occurred or omission occurred. It's a hard outer limit. It applies to
respect. Well, unless there's fraudulent concealment, and that's what they're alleging here, that you all hid, for example, the filing of a patent application without listing the inventors in
the statute of repose begins to run irrespective initially of the fraudulent concealment. That's a tolling mechanism. So unlike the statute of limitations that begins to run when a plaintiff knows or should have known, the statute of repose, irrespective of that, starts on the last day the act or omission occurred. The fraudulent concealment can toll the statute, but the start date continues. And if under Illinois law the discovery or the concealment arises if during the statute of repose period, fraudulent concealment has no application, which is what we argue occurred here.
You're arguing that the patent issuance trumps the fraudulent concealment?
There are two patents at issue here, the 352 patent and the 938 patent. With respect to the 938 patent, which we say the statute of repose began to run on the issuance date, that patent was issued on 6/03/03. At that point, the statute of repose began to run because that was the last act or omission relating to that patent. It began to run. Their argument then is that the fraudulent concealment told statute of repose, which otherwise would have expired in June of 09. The complaint was filed in November of 2009. The argument is that it told it. Judge Hibbler, or the lower court correctly, held that if and when, assume for argument's sake that they could allege fraudulent concealment, which we deny because of the issuance, but even if there was concealment, it has no application where the fraudulent concealment is uncovered or the plaintiff discovers their claim within the statute of repose period. Here, that is the statute of repose here began on 6303, expired 6309. MemoryLink alleges in its complaint that it discovered the cause of action in November 07 within the statute of repose period. As a matter of law, then fraudulent concealment does not apply and has no application. And as the Illinois courts have held, Maurer and a number of courts, it has no application.
But if the act or omission is the filing, which is one of the things that they're arguing, then it wouldn't have been covered under the statute.
Well, with respect to the 9-3 patent, I think that's what you're talking about. The 9-3 patent, the alleged malpractice omissions are threefold. They allege that we omitted to tell, or that the defendants omitted to tell MemoryLink about the filing of the 9-3 patent and that they weren't included as inventors. They also then allege in the complaint that we failed to notify them of the prosecution of the patent in July of 2002. So it's another omission. And then the last omission is that we didn't tell them of its existence and issuance in June of 2003. Therefore, the trigger date for statute of repose under the 9-3, I think it's not questionable, is the issuance date when it begins to start. And therefore, as the lower court held, the discovery, the admitted alleged discovery of the 9-3 patent, the inventors, and its cause of action within the 6-year repose period makes the fraudulent concealment have no application here.
Your opponent says that clear case law, which we could call a moment, indicates that the patent grant date isn't necessarily public notice.
I think the case he's referring to is advanced cardiovascular, which this court referred to. That's the only case we haven't. This court correctly pointed out that was a Latches case that applied the newer should have known standard, which is similar to the statute of limitations standard. Our argument is that that case has no application here because it was looking at an equitable doctrine, and unlike the statute of repose, it is not, the trigger date again is not based on equitable doctrine. In any event, while we do maintain to the lower court that the issuance of the patent means there is no concealment, so we do argue there's no concealment, as this court properly, as this court mentioned, it is clear that as a matter of law, if the statute of repose began on 6303 for the 9-3, it doesn't matter, since they allege they discovered it on November 27th of 2007 within the repose period.
But do you see as the effect of Ben Wyckoff's participation
So there's two patents at issue here. The 9-3 patent, which we just talked
about. I'd like you particularly to address the plaintiff's characterization of that relationship.
Okay. The Banner relationship comes into play with respect to the 352 patent application.
Right.
So irrespective of the 9-3, they obviously weren't involved.
Focusing on the assignment issue.
Well,
at least in part.
So Banner Wyckoff, as alleged in the complaint is, and it's not disputed here, was at least involved in patent counsel for MemoryLink on or before January 27, 2003. At that point, the record is clear, and it's alleged in the complaint, and documents are attached that Banner was looking at the 352 patent, that it filed a divisional application on behalf of MemoryLink, and in the letter attached to the complaint at the record A228, Banner sends a letter, Banner and Wyckoff MemoryLink's counsel sends a letter to Motorola stating and questioning modifying the ownership, which is in fact the assignment.
Right.
So our position for the statute of limitations argument with respect to the 352 and really with respect to fraudulent concealment as it applies to 352, that no matter what MemoryLink knew or should have known of the facts underlying its alleged injury.
Now, with respect to Ben Wyckoff's expression of concern about ownership, do we have in the record anything more specific about exactly what aspect of the ownership they were focusing on? Could you tell me on that?
in the record, they point to, I think, 8 to 28 is modifying the assignment. That's a January 27th or 29th letter. And the complaint also refers to the fact that they were looking at the assignment. Banner in July 29th, 03, and there's a letter attached. Sorry, I don't know the exact site to the record, but it's in here. Banner sends another letter talking about the assignment and changing the assignment to try to, remember to try to get ownership of the loan, and it actually starts
to draft. Ownership for remember.
It starts to draft.
And that would ultimately be because of Memorlink's position at that point. I'm asking you rather than saying, but that the two Motorola employees were not true inventors, was that the rationale for that argument, or is there
no? I mean, that's not in the record. There are no, I mean, that's in the other underlying complaint, which is really not part of this record, and I don't think that's been made at all in this case. Certainly it's not part of the record. They, what is said is that as part of the record is that Banner was looking at the underlying facts and issues that are the assignment and the on ownership. And what the case law said in Sound of Music and in Intercept and other cases that if and when there's a lawyer, the plaintiff's lawyer that knows the underlying facts, that whether or not they understand the cause of action, that ultimately is part of the injury, that's imputed knowledge. So Banner comes into play for our purposes with respect to the statute of limitations, we should have known date in January of 2003, which then would have expired in January of 2005, 5 years before they filed the complaint. It's a unique case here because what we have is a... I'm sorry.
Well, let's see if I can ask this way. My questions are very clear. Is there anything in the record that reflects that Banner and Woodcock were adverting specifically to the problem of the additional inventorship designations for the Motorola?
What plaintiffs, I believe what you're asking is, were they questioning the ownership?
Yes.
I think that's brief, that they did not need to. I think what is at issue is the underlying alleged malpractice act with respect to 352, where supposedly defendants failure to advise the legal standard regarding the inventorship, the legal significance of the assignment, and the fact that defendants allegedly represented that the two Motorola employees needed to be on the patent. That all occurred in June of 1998. The lower court held that at that point, the trigger date viewer should have known. We agree. But our position is that irrespective, the case law is clear that whether or not they were questioning inventorship, Banner in January of 2003 looked at inventorship. They filed the divisional and made a determination of who should be inventors or who should not be, and included the same four individuals. So the fact that they looked at the patent and inventorship, the fact that they looked at the assignment, the same issues that became the lawsuit 6 years later is unquestionably imputed knowledge, and it certainly doesn't support a fraudulent concealment with respect to the 352 patent. Moving to the, I guess, back to the 938 patent, we again, the allegations with respect to the 938 patent are threefold, as I mentioned to Your Honor, is the disclosing of the application, the patent prosecution, which occurred in 02, and then again, the existence and the issuance of the patent in 03. So we maintain, and Judge Hipler found, that the statute of repose triggered in 03. There is, again, no dispute that they discovered within the period. Similarly, with respect to the 352 patent, if this court decided that the correct...
If we were to find, though, that the actual omission for some purposes was the filing of the 938, then it would not have occurred. What is your response then? It's not, you can't get out of jail free with the idea that they discovered it during the period of time statute of repose.
If this court found the 938 trigger date was the June 98 date? Filing the application. If this court found that the June 1998 filing date for the 938 patent occurred, then the statute of repose period would have expired in June of 2004. And our position would be that it expired. We would then argue that the public notice, the issuance, was meant that there was no longer concealment at that time. Our position is, which I think I've said, is that here in paragraph 47 of the complaint at A63, plaintiffs specifically state that one of the omissions with respect to the ninth grade patent was the responding to the office action, the prosecution. The Maurer
case. Maybe one of the omissions. It doesn't mean the omission, which is the filing of the application of forming them, doesn't trigger the statute of repose.
Well, it does under Illinois law. Under Maurer and under Fricka, you look at when in a transactional context like this, you look at the last act on which the alleged malpractice omission occurred. And the Maurer versus Rubin, Fricka versus Bauer both found the case that you look at when the work product issued or when it was the final work product. In this case, that would be the issuance of the patent. It states that if there is, after that, some sort of continuing duty to correct or disclose, that's not going to delay it. But the statute of repose is considered to be the last act under Illinois law.
I understood Illinois law not to require accrual of the cause of action to divorce any circumstances, the good in case in particular, accrual from triggering the statute of repose. Is that correct?
I think the way the statute works is there's no accrual in that there is no knew or should have known standard, but it is considered clearly in a transactional conduct the last act. And the courts look at, in Maurer, for instance, they look at when the divorce agreement was finally issued and ordered by the court. That was the last act, and then to the extent there was silence afterwards. But whereas here there's three discrete omissions, the last act is looked at under Fricka and Maurer. The only way the fraudulent concealment would come into place is if after the trigger date, material facts were concealed. And we just believe that's not the case here. The concealment, while I want to flip quickly back to the 352 patent, we argue that under clear Illinois law, there must be material facts that were omitted. That was not the case with the 352, and there's no allegations of complaint that say there were. Finally, in my few last seconds, I didn't touch really on the statute of limitations, but our position is that the claims are equally barred under the statute of limitations, although we don't believe the court needs to get there. And then finally, our other independent basis for dismissal was with respect to the four individual Motorola in-house lawyers and Motorola, where we maintained independently before the lower court that there was no alleged facts showing a breach, and that under Twombly, that they, therefore, the claims against those individuals should not be maintained.
Thank you.
Initially, maybe I'm not smart enough, but all these different dates that are being bandied around, I can't follow them. It's pretty clear that what happened here happened in June 1998, when they filed the two applications, when they didn't advise about inventorship, when they didn't advise about joint ownership. To say that every time they then didn't tell MemoryLink that they had done that thereafter keeps the statute of repose open just seems like a catch-22. It'd be the same thing as saying in the DeLuna case, every time the attorneys in DeLuna didn't tell the plaintiffs that they hadn't filed, or that they had filed a complaint without the required affidavit, every time they didn't tell that to the plaintiffs, that somehow would keep the statute of repose going.
Well,
that just makes no sense.
So you specifically alleged in your complaint that it was prosecution constitutes a separate act or omission, another one, and issuance constitutes another act or omission. So it's not that they are saying just any event or day-by-day transgressions, but rather they're pointing to your allegations.
I don't think our allegations say that at all. I think our allegations are pointing at all of the different times when they should have told us about their omission and didn't tell us about their omission. Every time they communicated or should have communicated with us, they should have told us about what they had done, and they didn't tell us about what they had done. And again, every time DeLuna communicated with his attorneys to say that that was another act or omission, and that
patent, that... Once the patent issues, how can you say there's any further concealment? The patent is public.
But
I understand that your individuals aren't lawyers, but it's a public fact.
But there's, first of all, again, the advanced cardiovascular case, I believe it is fraud, but it's still an equitable proposition, and that case makes a strong case that you shouldn't have a plaintiff lose their rights because of constructive notice. Beyond that, to even suggest that somehow Memory Link or even Banner should have assumed that Motorola had taken Memory Link's invention, filed a second patent on it without telling them, and they should go to the patent office and search for the second patent. It just, I mean, Banner and Witkoff would have had to assume that the Motorola lawyers did something unethical, and I don't think that there was their obligation to assume that. I don't think that's their responsibility to assume that. This was a very complicated scheme, as alleged in the complaint, and it's difficult to me to imagine penalizing lay people, your Memory Link, because they weren't able to uncover that complicated scheme and rewarding the defendants for the sophistication and the subtleties of that scheme. And I think that's exactly why fraudulent concealment applies here. The only thing even remotely available out there was this assignment. And to view that assignment in a vacuum, without knowledge that they had played games with the inventorship, without knowledge that they had filed a second patent, secret patent, it just, as Napoleon once said, never attribute to the devious intent something that can be explained by bureaucratic incompetence. And I probably wasn't as clear as I should have been about this in the brief, but the Illinois law is actually clear, and that is that the knowledge that subsequent lawyers have is not necessarily attributed to the client. And if you think about it from the DeLuna perspective, that makes sense. In DeLuna, the trial attorneys didn't file the affidavit. The case was dismissed. Appellate attorneys joined the team, and they knew that the affidavit hadn't been filed. To attribute that knowledge of the appellate lawyers to the DeLunas would have meant that the DeLunas wouldn't have had a malpractice case against the trial lawyers. And nobody even suggested in DeLuna that would have happened. And also, if you look at the Illinois case as opposed to the ImmunoConcept case that they cited in support of that proposition, and ImmunoConcept of Texas law, which is apparently different in this, the Siegel case that they cited, all it was saying was that an attorney's notice that a hearing was going to take place was imputed to the client. It was a procedural thing. It wasn't a substantive thing. And in fact, it certainly wasn't on malpractice, and it certainly wasn't on fraudulent concealment.
Now, on the setting aside the question of whether attorney's notice is important, I understand your argument on Banner and Witkoff in 1938, and why isn't Banner and Witkoff on notice of the details of the authenticity?
Two responses to that. First is, I think it's reasonable that Banner relied on the original attorney's inventorship determination because the claims were so similar. In fact, if you look at the claims, and they're set forth in the brief, to a large extent, all the second claim tried to do was broaden out the first claim, and I think it frankly would have been a little shady for Banner and Witkoff to have charged Memory Link, a startup company, with a new inventorship determination when it was clear that the inventors should have been the same. They should have been the same. They should have been the two Memory Link people and not the two Motorola people. In addition to that, in Illinois, if a second set of lawyers joins the team, that does not absolve the first set of lawyers of their ethical responsibility. So even here, assuming Banner had committed malpractice, which I don't think they did anything wrong, but assuming they had committed malpractice, that would not have let the original attorneys off the hook, just as in DeLuna. The fact that the appellate attorney also was part of the malpractice and settled the malpractice claim did let the trial attorneys off the hook.
I don't think there's any suggestion you're not suggesting that Banner had been malpractice. The question is, did Banner have access to information that effectively gave the clients
And again, I think Banner, I absolutely don't think Banner did anything wrong. I think Banner had every right to rely on the original inventorship determination. Under Illinois law, it's clear that new attorneys who join a team are not required to go back and extensively re-review all of the work that was previously done. And so I agree that Banner did nothing wrong.
Thank you, Mr. Strauss.
Thank you.
Thank you.